Okay, so I am Josh Peek. I work at Columbia. I'm a researcher, so that means I just, you know, spend all day thinking about outer space, which is fun. I don't do too much teaching. I'm not a professor, but I love to talk to students, and I especially love to talk to teachers, because you guys get to talk to students. And I think the most important thing about astronomy is that it's a gateway. It's a gateway drug into science. It gets people really excited. It's, you know, what we do, what we provide as astronomers is pretty much nothing. Like, occasionally, you know, things like the laser come out of our studies of outer space. But that's not why we study it. We study it because it's compelling. I saw an internet video recently where somebody said, you know, what we should do with our time is both decrease the suck and increase the awesome. And that is one of the things we do with astronomy, is try to increase the awesome. So I thought that was a nice way of putting it. I'm going to be talking today about outer space, and this is sort of my slang lingo for the stuff between the stars. So when you think about outer space, you're like, okay, so outer space, it's got... anybody recognize any of these objects? This is a galaxy. This is a comet. Yes, this is what you do to your students, and they hate it, right? This is the sun. This is an asteroid, Eros, I think, a planet, and we've got a moon here. I'd like to add in, you know, maybe there's spaceships out there, too. But I'm not talking about any of these things when I talk about outer space, okay? I'm talking about none of these things. I'm talking about what happens when you take away all these things. What do you get? And what you think about, of course, is, well, you know, you go into outer space and, like, there's nothing there. It's this ridiculously hard vacuum. It sucks your eyeballs out and you die, and it looks like this. And that's, you know, all well and good, but it turns out that it's not just a hard vacuum. It is an incredibly hard vacuum compared to what we're used to on Earth. Incredibly low numbers of particles. But those very few particles are really, really important. So I'm calling it here outer space. And that's not, if you talk to your local neighborhood astronomer, they will not refer to this stuff as outer space. They will refer to it as the interstellar medium. And so when people ask me what I study at a conference, I'll say I'm an ISM astronomer, or I work on the ISM or the IGM, and I'll explain. So what does it mean? Well, stuff, right? It's not like the interstellar large or the interstellar small or interstellar medium. It's the interstellar extra, extra large. But anyway, it's the stuff that we're talking about. And then inter, of course, is between, and stellar is the stars. So this is like calling, I hate this name. I mean, I have to say it every day, but I hate it because it's like calling the ocean the interfish milieu or something, right? Like, the ocean isn't just about the fish, it's about itself. It's an interesting thing to study in and of itself. So it's defined in terms of, you know, because we saw the stars first, about the stuff that's between the stars, but I like to think of it as outer space. It's actually called all these different things depending on where you find it, and it does vary dramatically depending on where, you know, if you look near planets, if you look, you know, around our sun, you see something very different from if you look between the stars, or if you look between the galaxies, or between within clusters of galaxies. So there's all this different stuff, but we're still talking about the stuff that isn't objects, that's sort of beyond objects. And one thing I try to study in my work is, how do we examine this stuff that isn't things, right? Studying a thing is actually kind of easy, and that's one of the reasons astronomy is one of the first sciences. You know, you go look out in the night sky, and you're like, well, here's a star, and here's a star, and here's a star. They follow an incredibly simple motion, and so it's a very intriguing thing to study. Now, you look at a river that's flowing, and I'll explain to you sort of how the ISM is like rivers in some ways. It's way harder. There's all these different particles interacting with each other and so forth. And so that's one of the reasons that it's very hard to study the ISM, is that it doesn't have this very simple motion, the way that the stars move, at least from the perspective of the ancients. It's also very hard to see. Okay, here's a black slide for some reason. Okay, so I want to give you a sense of scale, one of the most important things to understand when you're teaching astronomy and... as I'm showing it to you here, is to understand the vastness of the scales that we're talking about. So each one of these, this is a log plot. And so each dot is a factor of 1,000 to the next one. So this is some scale, and this is 1,000 times bigger than that, 1,000,000 times bigger than the first one, and this is 1,000,000,000 times bigger than the first one. So 1,000, 1,000, 1,000. Okay, so I'm going to use this scale at the top of all my images so you have an idea of what we're talking about. You know, you see a picture of outer space, and you're like, oh, cool, outer space, that's huge. And indeed, it is huge, but sometimes it's this huge, and sometimes it's this huge, and 1,000,000,000 matters, right? So the solar system, the scale of the solar system is going to be my smallest scale. And that's about 200 times the distance between the Earth and the sun, which is called an AU, but we're not going to use that. If you go up about 1,000 times bigger than the, you know, Pluto to Pluto, or whatever you want to call it, the, you know, biggest scale of the solar system, you get up to the basically the star-to-star distance. That's the typical star-to-star distance. This is called a parsec. doesn't matter how big it is. If you go up another scale from that, you get to the size of a small galaxy. This is the kiloparsec, and I like to call this the foot of the galaxy scale. So if you're talking about galaxies, you measure them in kiloparsecs the way you measure a person in feet. That's kind of the way you could think about it. Our galaxy is maybe 20 kiloparsecs across, depending on how you think about it. A tall person. And then this is the kiloparsec, this is the megaparsec. So a million times the parsec, which is 1,000 times this basically scale of the solar system, and that's sort of the scale of a group of galaxies, or a cluster of galaxies. So as galaxies are in families, that's kind of their typical scale. To give you a sense of this, and this is not so relevant to you, but is useful for the public, I do the same thing, but with a sort of human-sized scale. So the small scale is the dime thickness. We're just going to convert directly. So I'm just going to start with my one unit as the dime thickness. If you go up another factor of 1,000, you get to about the size of the planet, 3 feet or so. Then you go up another factor, and you get Columbia main campus, 6 city blocks, and you go up another, and you get the size of California. So we don't actually have an intrinsic sense in general of what it means to be a billion times bigger, but that's a billion there, okay? So I'm going to combine these two, and I show you things, so you can either think in your head, if you want to just imagine all of this on the scale, on this human scale that you've experienced, that's how I do it. When I'm sitting at a desk, I don't think, okay, it's a zillion, gillion, billion, trillion, you know, like trying to imagine how big it is. I think of the galaxy as, you know, about this big, and then there's a cloud moving here, and then there's some stuff going on in here. You know, I think about it on a physical, normal scale, because, you know, sometimes people ask me, how do you think about those big things? And I don't. I just imagine them small. Okay, to give you a grander scale, the universe is really, really big. So I've taken the scale that I showed before, and I've extended it down to human scale. This is the size of Earth. I've also extended it up to the size of the entire universe. So this is a gigaparsec, and this is like 30 gigaparsecs. That's the size of like the observable universe. So you can see it's really, really quite large. And this is one of the reasons why this stuff between the stars is so important, right? Because if you imagine this to be 1,000 times bigger, let's say imagine this to be 1,000,000 times bigger. The size of the solar system is 1,000,000 times bigger than the size of the Earth. Well, that means the volume of the solar system is 1,000,000 times 1,000,000 times 1,000,000 times bigger, right? Because you've got length times depth times width, and so you know how volumes work. So this goes like L cubed, volume goes like L cubed. So it's not just 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, but it's that 3 times, okay? So you can have an incredibly low density medium, and it can be a huge amount of mass, okay? If you take one particle, one proton, a single proton, and you put it in a cubic centimeter, okay? So that's like 10 to the 26 times lower density than what you're used to. Something like that. 10 to the 23, anybody? Anyway, it's some, you know, very, very low density that, you know, if this room were full of it, it would suck your eyeballs out. But if you put it in a volume that's the star-to-star volume, it's got a mass of 20 Jupiters. Okay, so it's a lot of mass. The other thing I want to explain is that the universe is much bigger than it is old. What? So here's time. So this is the human lifetime, this is 100 years, and this is the age that the universe is. And it's just much shorter. The universe is actually not all that old, not compared to what we're used to. We're actually experiencing a rather significant chunk of the age of the universe. I mean, it's not really that much, it's only, you know, whatever it is, a billionth or so, or less than a billionth, but we're experiencing a lot less of its volume. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing to think about, that the universe is actually way, 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 way bigger than you're expecting, but only way bigger than you're thinking about in terms of time. Okay. This is another plot I'd just like to show. This is the universe's mass. Okay. And so you've probably heard of this dark energy stuff, and you've probably heard of this dark matter stuff, and I'm not going to talk about it in much detail today. Particularly dark energy, we really have no idea what it is. And dark matter, oddly enough, we don't understand what it is as a subatomic level, but we know how it moves pretty well. But what I really want to point out here is this bit. So even among the stuff, so this is, none of this is protons. None of this is the matter that you're used to on a day-to-day level. But all this stuff is. All this stuff is basically just acts like what you're used to. That's not what I wanted. How do I undo that? Yes. Okay, so 7/8 of that stuff is in gas. 7/8 of that stuff is in this outer space. And only 1/8 of it is actually in some, you know, planets and stars and, you know, things like that, things that are objects. So it's really interesting to study this. Now, you know, if I actually was interested in studying most of the energy of the universe, I'd just tell you all about dark energy for an hour, which I think is really boring. So this is not a very good argument. This, I think, is a better argument. So this is NASA's astrophysics budget. This is just the science and things related to it. And the thing I wanted to get at is this chunk, okay? This is proposed. This is a little while back. It's probably changed since. This chunk here is for cosmic origins. And I just want to point out, this is the biggest chunk. And that's because we're really interested in where things come from. One of the like big trends in astronomy in the last 20, 30 years has been how do things form? How do galaxies form? How do stars form? How do planets form? Where do all these things come from? Because now we can kind of get to those questions. And everything that is dense, like the Earth or the Sun, started diffuse. Right? The universe exploded. It was this high-density stuff that slowly became this big, diffuse pile of warm gas. And that gas just got lower and lower in density, and after a while, those pockets of material collapsed to form things. So anything that has ever formed in the universe started out as this gas that I'm talking about in one form or another. And so I think studying the gas is really interesting for that reason. Okay, so this is my basic outline. I'm going to talk about how you make this outer space stuff. I'm going to talk about how dirty it is, which is sort of surprising. Then I'm going to talk about what you can make out of it, because there's this recycling process from objects to space and space to objects. And then I'm going to talk about on the grandest scales. And I'm going to try to talk a little bit here about some open questions in astronomy, just to get you oriented in terms of what people are excited about these days, because I think that's interesting particularly to you guys. Okay, forming outer space. So this is a movie. You can see the scale on the top there. This is actually smaller than my dime scale or my solar system scale. This is the Sun, and what you're seeing is material being blown off of it through these magnetized winds. So you'll probably hear a lot about coronal mass ejections in the coming months. As the Sun currently is going into a stronger phase, you're going to see more and more material blown off of the Sun, and that's going to create corona borealis, aurora borealis, and all sorts of perhaps disruptions and satellites and interesting stuff. But in any case, what's going on here is that the Sun is ejecting some of its material. The material is going out into outer space. Now, this is a very low rate at which it's ejecting material. It's not like the Sun's going to go away anytime soon. And that's not how most of outer space is formed. But I just want to show you that on a human time scale and on a size that we can see, you can actually see this material lofting off into space. This is a star. This is a planetary nebula, which has nothing to do with planets, by the way. This is the world's worst term. It just looks like a planet when you look at it through a really shitty telescope. So that's the scale we're talking about here, smaller than the star-to-star scale, but bigger than the solar system. And that's the star at the center. What it's doing is sloughing off its material. This is a what's called an HB star, and this is the kind of star that our Sun is going to become in a couple of billion years, and it's going to slowly slough off material. And the material is getting sort of lit up by the light from the star itself, and you're getting all these beautiful colors. This is a Hubble Space Telescope image. This is actually super cool. This is a pretty new result. This is Omicron Ceti, or Myra, known to the ancients. Myra means miraculous, and it's because it brightens and dims by a factor of 1,000 over the course of like 2 years. And it's actually a thing I studied a while back, is how it does this brightening and dimming. But one of the things it's doing is, as it's doing that pulsation, is it's lofting off bits of its atmosphere. And so this is actually, it looks like a comet, but you can see it's this gigantic star-to-star scale. I mean, there's lots of stars across this length. And its material is being lofted off, and it's running into this interstellar medium that I'm talking about, this outer space. Material flows off, and it kind of becomes a comet as the star is moving through the space. This is an ultraviolet, and is... was taken with the Galax satellite, which is stuff that Columbia does as well. A lot of this is going to be Columbia-related. Just because I like to show my collaborators' works. So this is my sort of main diagram. So this is worth kind of understanding what's going on. So this is the outer space I'm talking about. And what I'm trying to show here is that the outer space is in a sort of recycling relationship to the stars. So there's two kinds of stars. For our purposes, we're just going to consider two kinds of stars that can be formed out of this gas. There's stars that are low mass, like the Sun, and then there's stars that are high mass. And when you cross about 7 times the mass of the Sun or so, 8 times the mass of the Sun, stars will die in a supernova explosion, what's called a type 2 supernova explosion, because we don't know how to name things, we call them type 2. And those type 2 supernovas can turn into black holes, they can turn into neutron stars or pulsars, but they return a lot of their material back into the interstellar medium. So you see this recycling loop. And this is what I just showed you before, this planetary nebula, where you've got a star that's returning its material to the planetary nebula. Some of it gets trapped in a white dwarf, but a lot of it goes back. So you don't have to worry about all these terms and which stars do what and so forth. The only thing to remember is that there's this recycling, that the material in outer space becomes stars and the stars become the outer space. Which means that studying outer space allows us to study the history of these stars. This is one of these supernovae. This is the Crab Nebula. the composite image using Chandra data, the X-ray telescope in space, and also Hubble data. This thing's only about 1,000 years old. The Chinese saw it happen. Pretty cool. And you can see it's just full of this very hot material. So as this stuff explodes, it pushes away the rest of the interstellar medium, and it sweeps it up. So it's sweeping up all this stuff, and that's what you're seeing lit up here, is the swept up material from the explosion of the supernova, which is still sweeping through the interstellar medium at, you know, probably hundreds of kilometers every second, okay, as it sweeps up this material. I mean, this turns out to be, I'll talk about more about how this is really important for not just the life cycle of stars, but for the life cycle of galaxies as a whole. This is the Orion Nebula, the Orion Nebular Cluster, to be precise. And there's a bunch of bright stars. This is our nearest stellar nursery of high-mass stars. So some of these group, this dense clouds of this interstellar material, you know, they collapse under their own gravity to form stars. And some of them form relatively low-mass stars, like the Sun. But if you get a big enough one, it'll tend to form these really high-mass stars. And so you're seeing this is the closest, what are called O stars, just happen to be the name for the most massive stars. And what's kind of cool is that these stars not only create, they affect their birth nebula. So you have this big pile of gas and dust, it forms these stars, and then they react back on the stuff. And this is what it looks like from a much wider view. So you may recognize this constellation. This is Orion. That's the Orion Nebular Cluster right there. And on this huge scale, this is the disk of our galaxy. You can imagine the galaxy like a big plate, right? And so this is a bubble kind of sticking off the bottom of the galaxy. I guess that's how we're oriented here. And this is called the Orion Eridanus bubble. And this is all X-rays. This blue stuff is X-rays inside the Orion Eridanus bubble. And this is other hot material, this red stuff. And this is cold material, this green stuff, neutral gas, which is what I study primarily. And you can see it's sort of bursting this bubble off the bottom of the galaxy, being blown both by supernova explosions from the stars, but also the stars emit these hot winds, just like I was showing for the Sun, like that, but much more powerful. And so the fact that they're in a group, that they're born in a group, turns out to be really important for blowing these big bubbles. And you can see we're getting up towards the galaxy scale here. This is a simulation by my office mate, Ryan Jung. And what you're seeing is a slice of the galaxy, again, simulated in a computer. And you're just looking at the plane. So we're looking at the very center of the middle of the plane of the galaxy. And the red stuff is the explosions, the hot gas that's being exploded out from these supernovae. So this is running over millions and millions of years, probably, I don't know, 50 million years or so. And this is the dense material. So this material that I talk about, this outer space, comes in a lot of different flavors. It can come in this really, really hot stuff that's fast-moving, coming out of stars, and quickly cools into this denser material, this blue and green stuff, which is much more static. So we do these kinds of simulations to better understand how this outer space flows over long periods of time, because you can't really see it move on a human timescale. It's so big. But even though it's moving hundreds of kilometers per second, it doesn't move along the sky really at all. It's very hard to see it change. So we do these simulations to understand where does the gas go once the stars form, how does the gas and the stars interreact. And this is actually a simulation that's in 3D, so you can see all these plumes coming out of the galaxies. Super cool. This is my work. I use the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico to look at neutral gas. So I look at this sort of cooler, calmer stuff. And here, I'll show you this giant swath of sky. This is about 180 degrees across, about 40 degrees tall. So it's this, it fills up your whole field of view. And that's kind of, you can see this is just area where we haven't taken data yet. And we're taking that data as we speak, probably. Here, I'll go back and show it again, because it's totally awesome. And one thing I want to get across about, you know, this interstellar medium stuff is that it's beautiful. It's this beautiful, strandy, complex material. We really don't completely understand why it looks the way it does. One thing I'm actually personally studying right now is trying to understand how these long, straight filamentary features, they're not, sort of one here too, where they come from, what creates these sort of needle-like features as compared to sort of more clumpy features. And this is one of the challenges for studying this stuff is because, if you're studying stars, you see there's a star, and it's, this blue and this red and this bright and, has this many planets around it or whatever. And you write that as an entry in your form, and then go to the next star, and maybe have a million stars, and then you do some statistics on them. It's very hard to do statistics on an image like this. There aren't any things. There's no thing. You just have all this diffuse stuff. So that's one of the big challenges that we're confronting right now, is how do we study this diffuse, complex material? What kind of tools can we use? Okay, so I've talked about you know, how you get outer space out of stars. Now I want to talk a little bit about this dirtiness. So astronomers like to talk about dust. And when they say dust, they don't actually mean dust. They mean kind of a soot material. This is dust. This is literal dust on some kind of condenser and a fan. And I think the technical term for this is gross. We study this stuff that's much more like soot. These little tiny particles that are typically formed in the winds of stars and also get formed out in outer space itself in ways we don't fully understand. And this is actually the only one we've ever tracked down to date. This is a little piece of aerogel from the Stardust mission, which went to sit behind a comet and pick up little pieces of material from the comet. But after it did that, and went and put this aerogel receptor and pointed it at space, at the direction we expect the flow of this material to be coming towards the sun, and it collected some number of these things. And this guy, I forget his name, has this thing where he gets people to look through these images and try to find these little streaks. So this one guy spent 10,000 hours and found this tiny little thing. It's amazing. Anyway, that's commitment right there. But that's not how we knew about these things to start with. We know about them because they impact light. Okay, really most of the way we know anything about outer space is through light. And what you're seeing here is the sunset, just past the sunset. So the sun is somewhere down here, and you can see this on a clear night with your eye. It's called the zodiacal light. And what's going on is in the plane of our solar system, okay, so you know, planets, sun, there's residual bits, material from the formation of the planets, and stuff that's ground up from asteroids running into each other and so forth. And that dust will, just like, I think of a good example here, just like dust on your windshield when you're driving towards the sun, will reflect some of the sun's light. And so what you're seeing here is sunlight reflected off of dust particles that are sitting in the plane of our galaxy. So after sunset, if you're ever out, in New Mexico or, wherever that's really far from New York City, after the sunset, look towards the sunset and you'll see a slight increase, a column of light that's not vertical, it's some sort of angle, and that's the zodiacal light, that's dust. Now that's the dust that's in the solar system, but there's tons of dust that's outside the solar system. This is dust around the Pleiades, this is the seven sisters, although I can either see six or I can see like 50. I've never understood why there are seven of them. Anyway, whatever. And I'm told some American Indians call them the six pigs, because they're really more like six of them. Anyway, point is, what you're seeing here is reflection here. There's a reflection nebula. These little strands are strands of this dusty material, this sooty material, that's being reflected from these stars. So that's another way we can see them. Our favorite way of seeing them, though, is an absorption. So just like when, as the sun goes down, it looks dimmer, what's going on is some of that light is being refracted away, deflected away, and so it's looking dimmer. And that's these black clouds here. This isn't a lack of stars. All this white stuff, all this increased glow here, are individual stars. That's what's creating that light. This black stuff is the dust that's absorbing or reflecting away the light from the line of sight. So you see all these crazy dark channels. And I'm actually told, I think it's the Incas. No. Maybe it's the Aborigines. There's some group of people that actually consider these constellations. They think about these objects as the constellations, which is, I think, kind of cool. Anyway, so this dust is really visible to the human eye. And if you're ever out late at night and you see the plane of the Milky Way, you'll actually see this dust too. Dust not only absorbs light, but it reddens the light. And so that means it preferentially gets rid of, reflects away the blue light. So it's the same reason the sky is blue and the sunset is red. Right, the sky is blue because light comes from the sun. It reflects off of atmospheres in the high particles in the high atmosphere, and then but it reflects differentially. The red light doesn't reflect as much. The blue light deflects more, and then that blue light comes into your eye. So that's why when you look up, you see the blue sky. You're just seeing the blue photons, the blue light from the sun being scattered into your eye. Right? Then if you look at the sun, at particularly at sunset, it looks redder, and that's because a lot of the blue light has been scattered away. This is the exact same thing here. This is called Barnard 68. It's just some dark cloud, pile of dust, probably will form stars someday. And if you look at it in the optical, you don't see anything. If you look at it in the infrared, the very, very far red, you can still see the stars. And that's because the infrared light isn't scattered away as much, isn't extincted away as much. Okay, so I've told you a little bit about dust. Doing pretty well. I'm going to talk to you about now the other process. Instead of talking about how you get outer space out of stars, let's talk about how you get things out of outer space. So we're going to go back to this, but now we're going to be focusing on this part. sorry, about, we were talking about this part and this part, how material was turning into, you know, sun was turning into outer space and affecting the outer space, and we were talking about how the sun could explode and give you these planetary nebulae. Now we're going to talk about this part. We're going to talk about, as you're forming stars from the outer space itself. So this is a nearby observation of one of these molecular clouds. So the general way you can think about stuff forming from outer space, as a complete gloss, but is sort of the way we think about it, is you start off with this diffuse stuff, and after a while it starts to feel its own gravity. And so it starts to collapse, and you become a denser and denser ball of stuff. And then that stuff will slowly fragment by very complicated means that people study all day long. And then those fragments will slowly form into individual objects. So this, and that process in the context of the interstellar medium is the formation of these molecular clouds. So basically you start off with mostly atomic material, individual atoms, primarily hydrogen. And as they get denser and denser, they have chances to collide with each other more, and you'll tend to form molecular material. You'll form mostly H2, you know, hydrogen-hydrogen bond, which turns out to actually be very hard to see, so that's a huge big problem in astronomy, is tracking down these molecules. But this is a big molecular cloud that will someday be forming stars. So this is sort of the beginning of the process of forming a star. This is, let's see, what is this? this is the biggest star in our galaxy, we think, which is going through all sorts of cool pulsations and stuff. And this is the nebula in which it recently formed. Just like in Blade Runner, those that burn twice as bright burn half as long or whatever. And so these stars, these bright white-hot stars, are going to die very soon. And so this incredibly massive star, Eta Carina, this is the Carina Nebula, this is Eta Carina. Eta Carina is going to blow up any day now. It's across the galaxy. It's not like going to affect us or anything, but it'll be cool to watch. And it's blowing this big nebula and going through these pulsations. But anyway, there's other stars still forming here. Okay, so you see these stars that have recently formed. And I'm going to zoom in on this little tiny trunk here. This is an image that's partially from an observatory in Chile and partially from Hubble. And what you're seeing here is this big, so the reason why it's dark is that it's full of dust. As it's gotten dense, the dust has gotten really, really dense, making it opaque. And at the very tip here is a star that is forming. What's completely crazy is these giant lines. These are called jets. And it is a very strange thing that we don't understand in astronomy at all. But when a star forms, it forms in a disk. So that sort of makes sense. If you could imagine, you know, imagine a big blob of gas, it's going to be spinning a little bit in some direction or another very, very slowly. But just like the skater pulling in her arms, it will spin up as it gets smaller. Okay, and so that's the reason why the planets are all in a disk, is that what happened, you had this big ball of gas, it was slightly spinning, it all collapsed into form a star, but that was spinning quite fast now because it's quite small, and that makes it oblate, you know, like spinning a pizza or something. So there's a disk in here. And for reasons we do not understand, these disks like to launch jets out of their axes. We really have no idea what makes those happen, but you can see, but this is a nice evidence that a star is forming in here, and you're creating these shock waves as this gas is being sputtered out into the rest of the medium here, into the rest of this outer space. This is like one of my favorite images of all time, just because it's so incredibly detailed and we understand so little of what's going on. So this is a zoom in of that. This is a different star, but same idea. You're seeing these jets sticking off. This is the disk. You're seeing it edge on, and you can see it's dark because it's full of that dusty material. So it's actually kind of like a disk that looks like this, like a flared disk, it's called. And you're seeing the light from the star reflecting off the inside of that flared disk. This is really cutting-edge stuff. And observatories like ALMA, if you've ever heard of that, that's being built right now up in the Atacama Desert in Chile, is going to be super good at looking at these. So look forward to really awesome pictures of stars forming with jets shooting out and probably even seeing planets forming in these disks. Okay, so now I want to talk about outer space on the larger scales. And I'm going to try to get into some slightly more conceptual stuff here. Tell me if any of this makes sense. And I want to kind of give you a better sense of what are open questions to astronomers, particularly in the questions of galaxy formation, which is a topic near and dear to my heart. So let's talk about this on grander scales. So this is a grand design spiral galaxy that you're seeing face on. And you can see we've gotten to the sort of whole galaxy scale here. The spiral waves are are basically a wave phenomenon. They're not a physical object. They're very hard to describe. But the long and the short is, what happens is the interstellar medium, this outer space I'm talking about, gets compacted up when it runs into these waves. Just like a sound wave, you know, as a pressure wave of air. So when it gets compact, well, as I said, you know, the stuff is going to get denser, and that density will trigger the formation of stars, okay? Because as stuff gets denser, it wants to fall in and collapse and form stars. So that's exactly what you're seeing here. These dense parts here is a dense, you can see this darker stuff is dust lanes, that sooty material I've been talking about. And then this area in pink are places where stars are actively forming. And you can convince yourself they kind of follow these spiral arms a bit. They're called H2 regions. And what you're seeing in pink is the light from these stars exciting the outer space itself, and then that's emitting in a particular transition of hydrogen, which actually does look pink. So you see all these like pink jewels along these edges. And you can also see these blue stars. The youngest stars, the ones that the big massive stars that die really quick, are quite blue. And so you see them oriented along these spiral arms because they've just formed as the spiral arm is passing through the galaxy, compressing the gas, forming stars, and you form these young stars, which then explode and so forth. So you're seeing sort of the whole life cycle by just looking at a single galaxy, which I think is kind of cool. But I'm going to show you a different galaxy. This is just one of many, many galaxies that we know about. There are more galaxies in the universe, by the way, than there are stars in our galaxy, which is kind of messing with you. This is another kind of galaxy. This is an elliptical galaxy, which you see looks nothing like a spiral galaxy, particularly visually. You know, you're basically just seeing all this glow is individual stars, and it's on the same ridiculous scale. So, you know, I could have put the spiral galaxy right there, and, you know, it looks really, really different. This is a jet of material shooting out of the central black hole in that galaxy. So black holes act the same way as young stars. They accrete material in this disk-like formation, and they shoot jet out of their axes. And again, we don't understand why something that's the mass of the sun, or that's the mass of a billion times the sun, has the exact same process, or how either one of those processes work. But this, you know, is this absurd scale, but you're seeing basically the same jet that I showed you before, but instead of now shooting out, you know, instead of being this tiny, tiny little thing happening inside the galaxy, I'm showing it to you on a scale where it's plowing out of an entire galaxy, out into intergalactic space. This is extremely high energy material that is glowing in the X-rays and ultraviolet and so forth. You know, these are two really cool examples of what outer space looks like on the galactic scale, but why do they look so different? Why do you have sometimes this and sometimes this? And that is sort of an underpinning question of galaxy formation. You know, we know that we start at the beginning of the universe, and there's some dark matter, and there's some gas, and then after a while, that gas kind of collapses into piles, and then those piles somehow turn into galaxies. And why do they turn into the galaxies that we see? We don't completely understand how that works. And I'm going to talk you through a little bit of the history of what we know about how galaxies form and why we thought what we thought when we thought it. So this is my, again, I'm trying to show you mostly pretty pictures of things because I think they're, I'm an observer. But I'm going to show you a little bit here, a diagram. So way, way back, the beginning of the universe, you know, most of the matter in the universe is this dark matter, particularly at the beginning of the universe. We just had lots and lots of dark matter. And the dark matter was basically evenly distributed. You can imagine just a completely homogeneous, extremely boring universe. But thank God, there's slight fluctuations where some parts were slightly denser and some parts were slightly less dense. So this is my schematic of dark matter. Excuse that it is light so that I can show it to you. That is slightly more dense than its surroundings. You know, over here, it's slightly less dense. So over time, what happens is it collapses under its own weight. Right, it's all, you know, the only thing that dark matter basically does is gravity. That's its only game. It only plays the gravity game. And so every one of these little particles in here is gravitationally attracting every other one, and it'll tend to collapse. Okay, so that's my animation of it collapsing. So now you have, these are called dark matter halos. And this is the sort of like standard unit that a cosmologist will talk about. They'll talk about the halo. So, you know, I have a halo. And that can be the size of a galaxy or bigger. And this, the idea is that these dark matter halos are what sort of nucleate the formation of a galaxy. So the original pencil and paper idea from the 70s and 80s was, check it out, we have this distribution of dark matter. It forms one of these halos. And there's gas around it. So now I've drawn in the gas in blue. The gas then says, hey, look, here's a big potential well. Here's a place where there's lots of gravity. Let's go to that. And so the gas gets attracted, and it falls into the galaxy and becomes dense inside the galaxy. You take all this huge amount of space, and it finds this halo, and it flows into it. Okay. Well, now it's become dense again, and like I've said before, low-density stuff becomes dense, wants to form stars, and this is how a galaxy is formed. And in particular, the idea was you had more dense stuff in the center and less dense stuff at the inside, so you'd form it inside out. The middle part would become the galaxy, would start to form stars, and the outside stuff would slowly flow in. And you could basically guess how fast a galaxy would form, how much material would form in it, by just using this. So this is sometimes what astronomers call the spherical cow approximation. Where you're like, well, I don't know how massive a cow is, let's approximate it as a sphere. And so, you know, it's a big spherical cow, which is a really stupid approximation for a cow, but at least gives you the same, you know, rough scale that it doesn't weigh 10,000 tons and doesn't weigh a gram. It, you know, weighs however many thousands of pounds a cow weighs. So this is the basically spherical cow approximation that was our first idea in the 70s and 80s. But as we looked around, we found that galaxies didn't really follow the math that came out of this. And so we invented these big computer simulations. So what you're seeing here on the upper right-hand corner is time in giga-years, in billions of years. So we're at 80 million years into the lifetime of the universe so far. And all I'm showing you is the dark matter. This is a big simulation of dark matter. What you're seeing is the dark matter slowly collapsing and forming denser structures, forming these halos. And you're just about to start to see, you see these little dots? Those are what astronomers call halos. And they form at the intersections of these big webs. And these simulations sort of were a gateway into a new kind of understanding as to how galaxies form. That they don't form in these isolated halos, but they form in these gigantic webs of halos. And that these halos were all talking to each other and were all colliding together and amassing. One of the great ironies of our understanding of our universe is that this is a dark matter-only simulation. There's no gas at all, there's no planets, there's no stars, there's no anything, there's just dark matter particles. And one of the great ironies is that dark matter particles, though we have no idea what they are made out of, we think they're probably some kind of weakly interacting massive particle that doesn't really do anything except for provide gravity, we can simulate them better than anything else because all they do is gravity. And so all this complicated fluid dynamic stuff, we can just sweep under the rug because it doesn't do, you know, there's no fluids going on here. It's all entirely gravity. So this sort of, this simulation we think we're doing really well, actually. In fact, people generally rely on these simulations all the time for doing, and they reproduce a lot of the stuff that we see, at least in terms of the dark matter. Okay, so why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because this has brought on this idea that came about in the 90s of mergers. The idea that what drove the evolution of galaxies was mergers. So instead of just being this isolated halo that's just sitting out there in space with gas flowing into it, it's actually that there's this tree. Any given halo, so this is a halo that corresponds to the Milky Way. We're getting down to about half the age of the universe. This is the Milky Way, and you can see it has all these little satellite galaxies around it. And this halo was built up of sub-halos. And so obviously what happened was you built all little stars inside these little halos, and they all rammed together and formed bigger and bigger galaxies. So this was our picture for a good long time. And it's certainly true that that happens. So we're going to have to cut out the last 3 billion years of the evolution of the universe. This is the antennae galaxies. And this is a collision of two galaxies. This is what's called a major merger. When you take two objects of like size and you smack them into each other, all sorts of crazy stuff goes on. So you're actually seeing all this blue stuff is where stars are forming. And you see all this dust, all this dark stuff is also these very dense environments. These are two huge tidal tails. When two big things interact, they'll kind of rip each other apart a bit. And this is evidence in our nearby galaxy that, indeed, galaxies are evolving through collisions. Now, it turns out these kinds of mergers are actually relatively rare. It's very rare that you have a really big thing and a really big thing of equal mass and smack them into each other. Much more often is where you have a smaller thing moving through a bigger thing. So this is a galaxy here within a cluster of galaxies. And what you can see is that it's moving this way, and its gas is actually being ripped off of it as it moves through a huge intergalactic gas cloud. So when you think about a galaxy, it's actually got gas all around it. I've only showed you mostly the gas in the galaxy, the interstellar medium. But there's also this huge extragalactic medium that this galaxy is moving through. In this case, it's actually moving through the medium of a cluster of galaxies. So even a cluster of galaxies can have this huge medium in it. This thing is screaming through it and having its material ripped off. So that material is now fueling into the rest of the galaxies. This is actually an observation of two galaxies, the large and small Magellanic clouds. They're called the Magellanic clouds, even though they are not clouds. If you go down to Australia or South America, you can see them with your eye. They're incredible. And this is a stream of material, and they're orbiting our galaxy, okay? This is a stream of material that's been ripped from them, and that material is going to help fall into our galaxy, and in a billion years or so, fuel the formation of new stars. So we know that this interaction between smaller galaxies and bigger galaxies does affect how galaxies grow and change, how their stars change, how material gets into them, how they form and get bigger. So that is important. We know it's important. And this is a really cool picture. This is done also by astronomers at Columbia. This is a nearest by collection of galaxies, cluster of galaxies, and each one of these is the gas in one of those galaxies. This is the X-ray light from this cluster. So you've got this thousands of galaxies in a giant pile together. One thing you can see is that the big galaxies tend to be towards the outside, whereas on the inside, a lot of the galaxies are missing their gas. And it's because as they've fallen into this giant cluster, all their gas has been ripped off. So again, this idea of colliding galaxies does really matter for understanding how galaxies form. But, we've learned, now I'm bringing you into the modern idea of what we understand about the way galaxies form, we've learned that actually a very small fraction of the gas gets into galaxies this way. So you might expect, okay, I'm a big galaxy, I just eat a lot of little guys, and whenever I want to form stars, I just eat another guy, that's cool, right? That would be one way of doing it. But it turns out that modern simulations that aren't just following the dark matter, but are actually following all the gas too. So this is one of the specialties of one of the guys I work with who's in my office. What he does is he takes simulations of the whole universe that don't just have dark matter, but also have the gas. And what that shows you is that if you don't just trace the dark matter, if you actually look at this outer space itself, it flows in these giant rivers, these streams. And these streams will fuel directly into galaxies. So instead of just a big sphere of gas that just happily turns into stars at the center, it's actually on these long funnels, these funnels of material. You can see these streams flowing into a galaxy. So this is a galaxy sort of about the same size as our Milky Way, and these streams of material that are falling into it. And this idea of what are sometimes called cold streams has sort of swept the astronomical galaxy formation community by storm for the last, say, 10 years. And we're all busily looking for these things. We can't, they're very, very hard to detect. They're very low density, they're very far away. But we're really interested in trying to track them down. So a lot of current work in extragalactic astronomy and particularly galaxy formation is looking for these streams. And I just want to show you, this is a simulation also done by a Columbia person. Each one of these points is not a star but a galaxy. This is the formation of a cluster of galaxies, and you can see that these galaxies reside along these streams of gas. I'm just showing you the gas here. And you can see all this material sort of flowing into these galaxies and flowing into the cluster of galaxies along these streams. So this is what we think is going on, and we think is crucial to the formation and the fueling of individual galaxies and of groups of galaxies. Oh, I'm going to be like right on time. And just to close, I want to point out sort of what I think the future is of understanding outer space and understanding the formation of galaxies. This is a nearby galaxy, M82, and astronomers, I was at this conference 3 weeks ago where this exact image was shown like 10 times. Because what it's showing is not just the green of the galaxy from Hubble, but also this incredible burst of material coming out of its insides. And what we've learned about the formation of galaxies is not just about the material flowing in, and I'm talking, formed from outer space, but also how it reacts back on its environment. So when you form a bunch of stars in the center, those winds all together, or the light from those stars, can propel the material not just away from the stars, but away from the galaxy as a whole. So you can have this material just shot way, way out beyond the influence of the galaxy. That's what you're seeing here. It's called a nuclear starburst, where it's a huge amount of stars are being formed at once. These are X-rays from the Chandra X-ray telescope, and then this is infrared light tracing that outflow. So one of the cutting-edge questions is this question of feedback. How does a galaxy, through its relationship to this outer space that I've been talking about, release material out into the universe? And how does that influence how galaxies are formed? So I think with that, I will thank you for your time. And, yeah.